Yes, today I'm honored to announce I'm joined by Forbes senior editor, Kurt Bettenhauser. Kurt, what's going on, man?
Crazy times we're living in right now, but all good here in New Jersey.
Okay, you're in New Jersey? I'm in Jersey, too.
Yeah, there you go.
So how are things going at Forbes?
We are busy. The media landscape has been hit pretty hard, without a doubt, and we're certainly not immune from some of the advertising issues that are facing the media right now. But our website has never been busier, ever. Busiest days on our website have been, you know, just about every day, so that's a new record right now. People are eating up coverage of number stimulus, coronavirus, those two topics in particular, and so they're turning to Forbes, fortunately, for a lot of answers. So that's a good thing for us.
Definitely. So you've been at Forbes for over 20 years. Talk about the experience. Like, what drew you to Forbes when the position opened up?
That makes me feel old. I graduated from college in the mid 90s, and kind of bounced around doing different things in sports, worked at NBC during summers while I was in college in their sports department, and when I first got out of college and tried a couple of different things, a couple summers in Washington, D.C., working in politics, and I ended up getting a job at a place called Financial World. I wanted to try something different, and it was a magazine that had been around. It was the oldest business publication around. It was older than Forbes or Fortune or Business Week, and but it was certainly smaller than those two, and gave me a great education on the business, on business journalism, and learned a lot of good mentors there, and ended up at Forbes after 3.5 years of Financial World, 1998, very busy time. Stock market had been on a 15-year bull run, basically.
Okay.
Forbes was booming. Every issue of the magazine was 400 pages. We just couldn't fill issues fast enough with editorial content, with how much advertising there was, and then that all evaporated completely. Okay. And the tech bubble, Internet 1.0 bubble, I guess, burst. The pets.com of the world disappeared, and the stock NASDAQ collapsed 80%, and advertising dried up. And ever since then, we've been in this gradual transition to the digital marketplace for journalism.
Okay. Do you think position in NBC Sports helps fuel your passion for what you do now, going inside the numbers of NBA players and other sports also?
I've always been a sports fan, and I've always been a numbers fan, and I've always liked to write. So I've found myself in a nice sweet spot where what I do at Forbes marries all three of those things. We do a lot of kind of very numbery type things at Forbes, in the sports area, and kind of dive into the financials, and whether it's sports teams or athletes or leagues or media deals, we really like kind of dissecting the numbers, and it's a fun angle to come at. This business, though, is transformed dramatically. I mean, in terms of the coverage of sports business, where when we started doing this, we started covering sports business at Financial World and valuing sports teams in the mid-90s,
right.
And there was no such thing as Sports Business Journal, and Darren Revelle was still in college, and, you know, it just didn't really exist, and now it's covered so closely, and you've got different verticals at The Athletic and CNBC, and that cover sports business in particular. And the area's come a long way, and that's because there's more money than ever in it. So it attracts a lot of attention just from the general medium.
Yes. Can you tell us, break down the Forbes high-speed athlete list? What factors go into making that list?
Well, what we try to do is really give people a peek behind the curtain at how these guys make the money. So salaries obviously get a lot of attention. Every big NFL contract that gets signed is Adam Schefter, one of these other ESPN insiders, has all the details immediately. And so what we do is we pay attention all year round, and that contract info is certainly important, and that makes up the vast majority of most athletes' pay. But what we really try to do is figure out what these guys are doing off the court or off the field or off the ice for hockey or out of the boxing ring or what have you, and really look at those businesses there, whether it's endorsements or licensing or royalty deals that they're cutting, or increasingly these guys are, you know, they're making so much money from their playing salary, those the guys at the top of the charts,
that they're
looking for ways to really make their money work. So that whether that's through investments in startups or getting into other businesses, and you know, everybody talks about equity. You know, they all want their equity, and that's how you become the billionaire. Through equity, it's not through just trading cash for a brand using your likeness. But those deals are tough. Not very few pan out at the end of the day. Most of them go to zero. But the ones that do can, you know, be home runs. They can, you know, everybody's chasing that 50-cent deal with vitamin water. Everybody's thinking, oh, I want equity now. But you got to be comfortable with knowing that, you know, equity might go to zero. And we see that in startups all the time where they don't have the cash to pay people. So you get equity. And that was with all these startups in the early 2000s with these companies were going public and creating instant millionaires throughout the company. But then in a lot of cases, the stock dropped to zero or near zero, and all that money and all those stock options that they couldn't sell yet until they the lockup periods expired, suddenly they were worthless.
Yeah, a lot of players, especially the top players, are coming to the league focused on their brand. I think Michael Jordan is a big influence on that. Like, he recently just came out and donated all his earnings from the much anticipated documentary The Last Dance. Like, he needs it. He's estimated like $2.1 billion. So I'm sure he can go without those earnings. But he only made like $90 million as a player, and he's now a billionaire because of off court earnings, especially with Nike and his investment with his team. How do you think Mike influenced that to, like, have players come into the league? Because the other players also, like Shaq. I believe you did an article on Shaq, haven't you?
Yeah, I've written about Shaq a few times over the years, and did a profile on him in the magazine early on. He's been an incredible businessman, and how he's stayed very relevant well into retirement. And he's, you know, Shaq will tell you, he's all about his brand. Everything about it has to be fun.
Yeah.
And that's his go-to thing. But Shaq's a great business story. You know, Shaq sold more shoes than Michael Jordan ever did, but he was selling them for $29.99 or $19.99 at Walmart.
Yeah, Walmart.
Instead of $199 from Nike. Shaq's been a great business success as well. Jordan, I mean, Jordan is the guy that all these guys look at, and they all dream of when they get that signature shoe deal. They want to be Jordan. I don't think there's another Jordan out there. I mean, in terms of making their money through shoes, It's hard to see another brand becoming that ubiquitous, where it's just, it's everywhere. I mean, Michael Jordan hasn't played in 17 years. And we looked at some of the Q scores, where different demographics, how they feel about athletes. And Michael Jordan's the number one athlete in terms of his Q scores. He's been basically since he came into the league.
Right.
But he resonates highest with teenagers of every demographic, which that is where his appeal is the greatest, which is incredible. They never saw him play. They certainly never saw him play with the Bulls. They might have, you know, a couple precocious kids who were 2 years old might have seen him his last year with the Wizards, but that generation was born entirely after he left the Bulls. But because of his shoes, it's this self-perpetuating cycle where they love the shoes, so I feel good about Michael, and then they buy more shoes, and then they feel, you know, good about Jordan, the person and the brand. And Nike, you got to give a lot of credit to Nike. I mean, they have done an incredible job marketing Michael, marketing the shoes, and with the supply chains, how they've handled demand and supply and creating excitement over every release is a Harvard Business School case study on what they've done.
Yeah, every time another pair of Jordan comes out, it's a line around the mall, not around the block, and on the mall. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and now what they're doing, which is even – they're making so much money now because everything – they're doing so much direct-to-consumer where they're doing it through online. I mean, they're cutting out the middleman. Yes, it's still available in retail, but so many Nike is selling so much inventory right now through Nike.com that it's really enabled revenue to grow significantly because you're keeping a much bigger piece of the pie on those sales if the retailer is not getting their piece.
Right. LeBron James has hit the block running since he came into the league. When he left the Cavs this last time, we all knew this decision was going to be more than just about basketball. He chose Los Angeles, and we all know it was more than just a basketball decision, because Los Angeles is filled with everything that he needed for his brand. I mean, he got up with Blaze Pizza, that took off, the production company, Spring Entertainment, now he's making Space Jam. I mean, he's on pace to be the highest paid NBA player this year.
Absolutely. What he's doing off the court is incredible. I mean, he keeps adding deals left and right, too. I mean, did a deal with Walmart. He's got his traditional endorsement deals. And then, as you mentioned, all these businesses that he has gotten into, and he's becoming a serious media mogul. People are taking LeBron and his team very seriously, and while things might not have looked so good last year in L.A., they look pretty good right now. They're set up in a nice position to be a competitive basketball team for a couple of years and challenge for titles, and it just adds to his legacy on the court, and that only helps the business. So he's out there not only making the connections in the business world, but also – you know, continuing to add to his legacy as a player, which is just staggering what he's done. So, he can't. I mean, what he's done off the court is too incredible, and he will tell you that's his greatest legacy. And helping the kids, school kids in Akron, and with his I Promise School is really incredible. I mean, he's a slam dunk what he's done. I mean, in terms of on the court, off the court, philanthropy, he checks all the boxes. Can't ask for more. And a guy who came into the league with crushing expectations for rescuing basketball in Cleveland, giving the NBA a shot in the arm when, you know, it was still, I want to say, reeling after the retirement of Michael Jordan, but it still hadn't bounced back and recovered really from Michael, who had, you know, took the league to incredible heights. And then when he left, kind of sucked all the air out of the room for a few years there. And the Lakers started winning. That helped. LeBron really gave the NBA a shot in the arm. And now you have all these superstars who are turned into global superstars with the help of social media and with the shoe companies that back them.
Yeah, one player that just recently stepped on the scene, well, the NBA scene, is Zion Williamson. I haven't seen a player with this much hype behind him besides LeBron James. We know LeBron James came into the league with, like, the biggest microscope on his back ever. Zion, on hype alone, was, like, the favorite for Rookie of the Year before he even stepped on NBA court with injury delayed that. But what do you see his earning potential to be? Because he's, like, just a magnet already.
Yeah, I mean, the sky's the limit for the guy, 100%. I think, you know, for him to take that step, though, to go from, you know, all-star, you know, really popular player to that next level, the LeBrons, the Steph Currys, maybe I put KD in there, but I think Steph and LeBron have kind of separated themselves in terms of marketability. You've got to have success in the playoffs and ideally win championships. Really hard to do that if your season's over in April every year.
Sure.
Or you're not getting out of the first round of the playoffs. I mean, the NBA more than any other sport, winning matters. In terms of elevating someone to really that next level of just being global superstars. But Zion has all the tools. I mean, whether it's his name or his game itself, his personality. He exudes so much positive energy. I interviewed him at the beginning of the year for something, and I mean, he was a breath of fresh air. I mean, that's the only way I can put it. And he was terrific and humble and says all the right things, and everything seems super genuine, and nobody has a bad word to say about the guy. So I think the Jordan brand is in good hands with Zion, and, you know, knock on wood, kid stays healthy and leads the Pelicans to success. And, you know, he doesn't have to go to L.A. to be a superstar. I mean, LeBron became a superstar in Cleveland, and Durant
became
a superstar in Oklahoma City. The way the NBA is set up right now, would it help that he was a superstar in New York and revitalize that franchise? Probably. I'd probably get a couple of bonus points for that. But he can be a giant marketing sensation in New Orleans. Absolutely.
Yeah, a lot of players choose a destination off of their brand. Like, a lot of players like New York, not a lot of people want to play for the Knicks, but they like big markets. They see more money there.
Yeah, I think so. But the NBA, I think, it's become so international that, you know, and again, the shoe deals get behind guys and market them internationally. So the fact that he's in New Orleans, you know, I mean, it's not ideal, but it wouldn't stop him or preclude him from being a big superstar. So people know New Orleans too. I mean, it's because of Mardi Gras and its history, and, you know, people. It's a city that punches above its weight, I would say, in terms of it is a relatively small city in terms of U.S. cities with sports teams in it, but I think it punches above its weight a little bit just because of the rich history of the city.
Yeah, these shoe deals, especially with Nike, have become massive. When Kevin Durant signed a 10-year, $275 million contract with Nike, he's made more money with Dome than he has in his 12-year career, which is crazy. He'd arguably the second best player on the planet. Some might say he's first.
Yeah, the shoe deals are, you know, they are gigantic. And it's going to be very interesting how everything's going on with this pandemic, how things shake out, because It's going to change how endorsement contracts are treated going forward. The performance shoe market has really struggled. They're not selling performance basketball shoes. They're down pretty much year after year, those sales. The shoes that are selling are the lifestyle basketball shoes, whether that's the retro ones or the new releases. So I think Zion was really an exception in terms of seeing a huge deal for a rookie. I don't think you're going to see a lot of rookie contracts. I don't think you're going to see another rookie contract like that for a while. Most of the big guys are locked in, Durant and LeBron, Steph, even James Harden, with Adidas, they're locked in kind of long-term. It'll be fascinating to see what that next big, free agent on the shoe market, how the brands treat them right now. In a post coronavirus world, we're working on our latest look at the highest paid athletes, and it's interesting talking to brands and agencies and what's going on with their clients and how different endorsement deals are being treated, because it's everything's going to get reevaluated in terms of how people spend their money.
I want to get your thoughts on how TV revenue is playing a role in these massive TV NBA contracts, because there's a lot of role players that getting like double they would get on the market if it weren't for these TV contracts. Like, you have like second tier players, like he's like Bradley Beal. Some might say he's an all star, but he's a second tier all star.
Are you dissing on Bradley Beal?
No, I love Bradley Beal. I don't. I mean, like he just recently signed a $72 million extension.
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. That might all go away too. I mean, these guys have been signing huge deals because the cap keeps going up and up and up. Because of the TV deal, and not only the national TV deal, but everybody signs a local TV deal, which gets factored into the salary cap. Those local TV deals are gigantic. I mean, the Lakers being at the top of the heap, they're getting $5 billion over 20 years. Over 25 years. So that keeps raising the cap level. But now, I mean, the cap has the potential to get hammered next year. I mean, it's almost inescapable at this point. Unless they can pull a rabbit out of a hat and actually have the playoff and secure those revenues somehow this summer. And then the cap won't be hit that much hard. But they will be maxed out in terms of, the deals just won't be available. Because you can make exceptions. There's a bunch of different exceptions to get around the cap itself. But once the NBA teams are willing to go above the cap, but they don't want to go above the luxury tax, because then those penalties get really oppressive. So we've seen the luxury tax almost work as a unofficial cap, where only 2, 3, maybe 4 teams are willing to exceed it yet each year. So I think we saw so many of those deals when the salary cap first bumped up. After the new TV contract kicked in, and the league was trying to gradually bring in the bump in the salary cap. Instead, the Players Association pushed back and said, no, we want it all at once. And you had this flood of money came in, and just crazy contracts with guys who were getting paid, probably 100% higher than they should have been. So, because teams are going to spend. If they have cap room, they're going to spend it.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to. So, good time to be an NBA player. I mean, the average salary
yes, it is
$8 or $9 million. It's pretty good. If you think about the average NFL salary, it's probably about, still under $3 million.
Franchise evaluations one team that comes to mind when this always comes out is the Knicks. They've been, like, basically dysfunctional for a while now. But the things James Dolan has been doing and the losing that's been going on. But evaluations come out for franchises, they're always right near the top. You think on location always, because they're in New York, like capital of like marketing. You think location plays a major role in the Knicks always being in the top of the franchise evaluation?
I'd say it plays the only role.
The only role.
we look around at how we value these teams. The Knicks are first. The Rangers are first in the NHL. The Yankees are first in Major League Baseball. The NFL operates a little differently because all the TV money is shared. But the Jets and Giants are both in the top 10 because they're New York, the New York market at least. And, you can charge more for – there's just more money from individuals, corporations. So they're going to buy luxury suites. They're going to buy ad signage. They're going to buy courtside tickets that cost, I don't know what they're up to, $3,000 a game. I think Spike Lee's paying whatever it is, $3,500 a game.
Said he's paid what, 10 mil or something?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what it comes down to. And if they were ever to come up for sale, they would blow away the price that we value it at, because somebody who's a lifelong basketball fan and lives in this area and has made $12 billion as a hedge fund manager, and this is their one chance to buy a team, and they of course think they can turn it around and be a success on the court, and fans still show up. I mean, that's what it comes down to. They still pay for all this, and they generate, despite never going to the playoffs, they still generate more money than anybody. Now, the Warriors' new building will generate more this season, but up until the Warriors' new building, their revenue is still the highest. They have a huge TV deal, even though ratings keep plummeting on MSG. And that's what it comes down to. They just generate more money than anybody else, despite being terrible. So Dolan got a lot of peak for spending $1 billion to renovate MSG. A lot of people thought it was just a vanity thing, and he was just sinking money into it. Why was he spending all that? Well, it paid off. I mean, that building was totally transformed, and they created a lot of new revenue opportunities in terms of club areas and how they could price the suites. And concessions, and the ability to have other events at MSG, so it has been a great return on investment for $1 billion renovation, which is a lot to spend to spruce up a building.
Definitely, the NBA is a life-changing experience on more than just one level. What do you think? What's your take on the importance of players being financially educated when it comes to the league? Because a lot of players, mostly all players, haven't seen that much money that they're going to get once they get signed to the NBA, and that can be overwhelming for anyone without a good supporting cast around them. I mean, the league implemented the program for to help rookies, but that's still a lot of money to get if you're not used to getting that.
Yeah, it's a really tricky situation. Not as much money as there used to be with the rookie salary.
Yeah,
still a lot of money if you're a first round draft pick or a second round draft pick for that matter. It's one of the biggest challenges that all the leagues face. I mean, how do you control what a 20-year-old is going to do if they're suddenly given signed a guaranteed contract for $30 million. It's all they can do is educate it. I know the leagues and the players' union all take it very seriously. That's the last publicity they want is guys getting into financial trouble, guys going broke who've made $100 million in the league over 10 years. And they just keep educating, you know, and I know veteran players push really hard to try to help out the rookies so they don't end up in bad places. But, I mean, there's plenty of bad apples out there that are sharks and go after these guys. and promise them the world. So we'll continue to see these stories, but I think how they, you know, the forced mandatory education of these players as they're coming into the league, the before they play their first game, having to sit through these rookie symposiums to get a financial education, it helps, and they bring out the Antoine Walkers and the other guys who have gone broke despite being all stars and making $100 million, and those guys talk, and I think that's the best thing they can do to get through to these people, because Antoine Walker stands up there, I said, and says, I never thought that would happen to me. Well, it does. But it's a challenge. It's a balancing act for the leagues and the unions.
You cover a lot of sports. The WNBA, I don't know if you followed that closely, but this is a marketing question. What do you think they might can do to help bring in more revenue to them? Because all the time I hear the players, they're complaining about how much they make. They want to make almost as much as NBA players do, but it does come down to how much the league makes that they can break down to get the players.
Yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, the salary equation is determined strictly by how much. If you don't have the revenue to pay, them,
yeah, you can't
pay those salaries.
Right.
And for the WNBA, it's about exposure, getting more eyeballs on the game. So whether that's through TV or the audience. And I heard an interesting argument this week about how they have players have felt that the NBA is holding them back to some degree because it limits the sponsorships they can do because they are a subsidiary of the NBA. And so if NBA has a national deal with Coke and Pepsi wants to come in and do a national deal with the WNBA, the NBA says, well, no, we can't do that because that's a conflict with our main partner. The NBA has financially supported the WNBA for two decades now. And as they've lost money every single year. But they can still continue to cover those costs, and there's an argument to be made that the power of the NBA helps bring in deals for the WNBA if they can negotiate it together. But the WNBA feels like they're just a throw-in in any sort of deal that is done with the NBA, and so that really reduces the value. So when NBA does a TV contract with Turner and ESPN for $2.6 billion a year, 99% of that money is allocated to the NBA and 1% to the WNBA. And so that's why NBA salaries are 100 times higher than what they are in the WNBA. So they need to be able to generate money on their own. For smaller sports leagues, it's hard to do that through TV.
Yeah.
You just can't generate enough money. You really need to be able to do it. That arena experience is so important, and you need to be able to generate money that way with, butts in the seats, as the people say.
Very true. Mark, can you recall the most interesting person or player you evaluated?
Most interesting person?
I know you've done a lot of interviews over the years. A favorite interview? Let me rephrase that.
I would say maybe I'm partial just because he just passed away tragically, but certainly Kobe Bryant is one of the most engaged athletes that I've ever interviewed. Engagement levels can kind of swing up and down when you're talking to people who are super famous and tired of talking about themselves or being interviewed by the press, but a couple times I've interviewed him, his engagement was off the charts. I mean, totally passionate about what he was talking about, and we didn't talk about any basketball stuff. It was all off the court stuff with the media business he was building and his investment business that he was building, and Body Armor. which he was investing in, and he was a terrific interview. Both times I've interviewed him.
Yeah, still doesn't seem real. Thin moss now. It's crazy.
Yep.
Kurt, thank you so much for joining me, man. I enjoyed this. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for having me on.
Talk to you soon.
Okay. All right. Be well.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, that was Kurt Vanderhauser, Forbes senior editor. Catch you next week.